When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
It's How Do We Fix It with Richard and Jim.
A fresh look at freedom. Russell Shorto. Why did you write it now? I mean, why does it have special resonance today,
well,
as opposed to, say, 5 years ago?
Well, that's, I think, partly accidental, because when I was working on it, I thought I was doing history. You know, I thought these things were long ago settled. I didn't think I would be living in a time when freedom of the press and freedom of religion and freedom of speech, these things would be debatable or even under attack.
How do we fix it?
So before we begin, Jim, what does this show mean to you?
You didn't give me any time to prepare.
No, absolutely.
Well, I was coming in today, and I was just, you know, we're reading this fantastic book by Russell Shorto, and we've met so many interesting people, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and discussing big ideas. So I just love being involved in the important conversations happening today, looking at it from this great variety of perspectives.
And if you want to be more involved and help us, then please rate us and review us on iTunes, give us 5 stars, and also write a review.
That really helps our visibility. It helps spread the word and helps build this sense of community that I hope we all share.
That's a pretty good answer. Jim, this show reminds me of episodes when we spoke with Michael Shermer when he made the case for skepticism and science, and Stephen Greenblatt, who spoke movingly about Adam and Eve and our very human need for origin stories.
Today's show is kind of an origin story about the origins of our country and many of our values. We're interviewing Russell Shorto, an author many people know from his great book, The Island at the Center of the World, about Manhattan in the days of the Dutch in the 17th century. His new book is called Revolution Song, A Story of American Freedom. And it's what we're both reading it and really enjoying it, because it tells the story of the American Revolution, not just from the perspective of George Washington and some of the other founding fathers that we know, but from an Indian chief, a slave, and seeing perspectives that are very different from the ones that we typically associate with history.
At a time when democracy is challenged, we thought it was a good idea to speak about freedom. What does it mean to you? Why is it important?
Russell Shorto, welcome to our table.
Very happy to be here.
You write, I think it's on the page one of your book, that in a sense, the American Revolution never ended. What do you mean?
I think the American Revolution was fundamentally a promise of freedom. We think of it as political freedom. That was the main thing. And it was partly fulfilled. What was fulfilled was a remarkable thing that had never happened before, this republic, this one person, one vote idea. But even that, it was less than 10% of the people who had the vote at the time. It was essentially white men who owned property. But political freedom was only one part of this larger wave of freedom that had to do with individuals, individual freedom of all kinds. So if you think about it, all of American history, in a sense, has been an attempt to unravel these other freedoms that were not fulfilled with the Revolution, the Civil War, the Civil Rights Movement, even things like consumer rights.
Now, most people, when they think about the Revolution, we know the stories of the signers of Ben Franklin and George Washington. But your book also focuses on a lot of people who typically aren't part of that central narrative. In fact, you say there were many sides to the conflict, many different people clamoring and clawing over freedom.
Yeah. My idea from the beginning was not so much to write a book about the American Revolution, but to get a feel for what it was like from different perspectives to live through it. And so I, years ago, started with this notion that I would pick an assembly of people from very different backgrounds, and they had to be people whose lives were well documented, because I'm doing nonfiction. Because I wanted it eventually to be one story, they had to fit together. I mean, they didn't all have to sort of be in the same room at one point together, but the stories had to fit together to some extent.
Why did you write it now? I mean, why does it have special resonance today, as opposed to, say, 5 years ago?
Well, that's, I think, partly accidental, because when I was working on it, I thought I was doing history. You know, I thought these things were long ago settled. I didn't think I would be living in a time when freedom of the press and freedom of religion and freedom of speech, these things would be debatable or even under attack. So it's in the past year or so, I had the sensation that these documents that I have been kind of up to my neck in for the past 4 or 5 years, suddenly people are returning to them and saying, well, wait a second, what is this all based on?
And for you personally, I mean, when you think about those values that the American Revolution brought to the fore and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, what particularly speaks to you?
My historical training, where I've really spent time, is in the 17th century. When I wrote my book, The Island at the Center of the World, about the Dutch founding of New York, in part out of this fascination I've always had with the 17th century and the moment when people suddenly started to see themselves as individuals the way we do. Before that, you were completely bound up with your guild and your church and your synagogue or your parish or whatever it was. And at that moment, when they started peering into telescopes and microscopes
Like Descartes into their own minds.
Exactly. Right. People like Descartes suddenly saying, wait a second, we all have this thing called reason, and it connects with the universe in this mysterious way. And that means every individual is equally valuable, equally worthy, equally worthy of a vote.
I don't think people appreciate what a shocking, it was almost like a Copernican revolution in our idea of the person.
Exactly. So that's where I've always kind of gone back to, that moment. And in the years since I wrote Island at the Center of the World, I think kind of in the back of my mind, I sort of marched forward decade by decade, and I came at the American Revolution from the other side. And when I did, I saw this wave that had been building in Europe and then in America kind of infect people here. And then you see the leaders here in their disgruntlement in England suddenly decide to kind of package this, to sort of train the beam of it onto this notion of political freedom and no taxation without representation and those kinds of things.
And yet your book, Revolution Song, is a very unorthodox look at the American Revolution from many different perspectives.
But again, this is all, you know, this force that started a century before was all about individuals. So I thought I wanted to look at it from different individuals' perspectives, not just the perspective of the men in their powdered wigs, but, you know, what did it feel like to be a slave in the period, to be, in the case of another of the people in my book, a loyalist woman, to be at the street level, to be a tradesman.
That was one that really captured me, your story of Abraham Yates, this shoemaker who was kind of self-educated and became a low-level official in the city of Albany when it was really a raw, almost a frontier town. And yet he was outraged at the British putting all their troops in everyone's houses and abusing the local population during the French and Indian Wars. And he wrote this amazing legal memorandum. In one of the lines, he says that people have a fixed fundamental right born with him as to the freedom of his person and property in his estate, which he cannot be deprived of. It's such an early, and this was years, this is 20 years before.
So in other words, troops can't just show up and say, we're fighting a war, and we need to take over your house.
And your food and everything else.
Right.
20 years before the Declaration of Independence.
And he is a nobody. I mean, most people have not heard of him, which is one reason I was attracted to him. Which goes to make the point that this was really in the air. People at all different levels of society had this notion of freedom and how it applied to them. At the same time, armies were squaring off at Saratoga and Lexington and Concord. Husbands and wives were interacting with each other in a different way. And you see it reflected like from the 1750s to the 1770s. In the 1750s, a family portrait was the woman and children sitting like on a sofa and the man standing. By the 1770s, they're all on the same level. They're all standing. So in these little ways, you see, you know, at the social level, you know, these freedoms or where we stand as individuals have a different resonance.
So speaking of differences in gender roles, one of the characters that you talk about is Margaret Coughlin. I hope I have the pronunciation right.
Coughlin or Coughlin. It was since they didn't have recording devices, we don't know how she pronounced it.
Tell us about her, because she's kind of an extraordinary woman.
She is, and she's not. A couple of interviewers have asked me, why did you not pick someone who is a more representative of women at the time? And I chose her, I think, because she's very atypical, but she also represents, I mean, it would be anachronistic to talk about a woman's movement at that time, but the cutting edge of it was forced marriage. There were plays being written and newspaper articles arguing that a woman should be allowed to marry for love and should not be forced by her parents. And that is exactly what happened to Margaret when she was a teenager in the middle of the war. Her father, who was a British officer, decided she would marry another British officer whom she despised. And then she tried to rebel, then she was forced to anyway, and he was abusive. She eventually leaves him. She's very bold. Throughout her life, she makes several dramatic
which
moves.
Is almost unheard of.
Leaves him in Wales, walks off into the mountains, walks 60 miles, and never sees him again. She wants to have a life of her own. She wants some form of independence, which was basically impossible for a woman at the time. And so she identifies two role models, two ways to do it. You could either become an actress or you could become a mistress to somebody powerful. She tries both. She's more successful at being a mistress, and so she becomes a mistress to several important men in London and later in Paris. And so her life is this tragedy where, you know, she's from high to low. She's like attending all the state dinners and balls and things, and the next moment she's in debtor's prison. But the trajectory of her life comes out of the American Revolution. It would not have happened the way it did had the revolution not existed. And out of this notion of freedom and where it was at that moment.
And another story that really spoke to me, even though the experience is so alien to me, about someone living their life devoted on a journey to freedom was the story of Venture Smith, the slave who was brought over from Africa as a boy.
Venture Smith was a fascinating man, born in West Africa at the age of 10. His village was attacked by an invading army. He was taken into slavery. Another army attacked them and took him. They took him to one of these slave trading ports at the coast, and the ship that was in the harbor happened to be from Newport, Rhode Island, and so he ended up in New England as a slave and worked indefatigably to save money to free himself and then eventually his family. And what's interesting to me about that is all of his effort, this really dogged effort, which he describes, he dictated his life story at the end of his life, is taking place against the backdrop of the Stamp Act, the Townsend duties, where white people are clamoring, this growing clamor for freedom, which he basically is ignoring. Because he's saying, in effect, I am not trusting that that's going to apply to me.
Yeah, that's not my fight. That's somebody else's.
Yeah, it's just not going to. I don't believe it.
How does his story, as he tells it, differ from the traditional narrative by abolitionists? Because the stories of slaves were often written, but not by themselves.
That's right. And there's a whole category called slave narratives, which when I was researching the book, I knew I wanted to have a focal point be one of these people. And most of them, it turns out, were processed by abolitionists, these narratives. And they went to them, I mean, with this noble purpose. They were trying to build a case file of stories to use to change the law. But in doing so, they kind of homogenized, they Christianized, they put a heavy moral tone over it. One historian calls this a black message in a white envelope. Venture Smith's story is not part of that. It's clearly his own motivation and his voice comes through strong. And so that's one thing that really attracted me to him.
This is How Do We Fix It? I'm Richard Davies.
And I'm Jim Meggs.
And our guest is historian Russell Shorto, who is author of Revolution Song, A Story of American Freedom.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You know, it's impossible to read this book without thinking about everything that's going on in politics today. And one thing that struck both Richard and me is that in a way, it's a rebuttal to some of the nativism and, you know, even white nationalism that we hear. You find these threads that go into the making of America in all these different sources. It wasn't just those guys, as you say, in the powdered wigs in Philadelphia.
And not just that, but the country was German. It was Dutch. It was Iroquois. It was Munsee. It was Shawnee. There were people speaking different languages. There were different communities that were quite closed off from the rest of the colonies. And then there were these quasi melting pots in the cities. So it was a very diverse place from the beginning.
Really cosmopolitan in many places.
The cities were cosmopolitan. Certainly New York was.
Talk about Corn Planter, a Seneca tribal leader. His real name escapes me.
Kayetwake. Corn Planter is a little easier to... I was drawn to him. I wanted to have the native perspective because they have, you know, to talk about two sides, well, the native side is another side. But even at that, they're all different tribes, each of which had their own stake in what was going on. He is... What appeals to me about him is that he is this... He's the kind of stereotypical noble warrior, but he's also this philosophical, a political animal, a realist who is progressively drawn into the complexity of it. And I think part of what makes up his nature is the fact that his father was actually a Dutch American from Albany. He was an Indian trader. And so when Corn Planter was growing up, other kids in the village basically would make fun of him because he looked, his skin color was different and things. So it sets about this different... identity.
And he was a member of the Seneca tribe, which was part of the Iroquois nation?
That's right. With the Iroquois, there were six nations, and the Seneca were the westernmost of them.
Okay.
And so he takes part in one of these gatherings at which they're debating whether or not to take part in the war. He argues strenuously that they stay out of it. The vote goes against him. And so he goes along with his people, fights viciously, burning down American settlements and attacking forts. Then the war's over, the British lose, which means the Iroquois lose. The Iroquois decided in the Revolution to side with the British, figuring that the British were much stronger.
Well, the British had won the last war.
And the British, Joseph Brant, who was Corn Planter's sort of rival for supremacy, had been to London. He'd seen this society, and he came back telling people, look, these guys are going to win. They've got, you know, a society that you would not believe. So Corn Planter was overruled. The British lose the war, which means the Iroquois do too. And then the Iroquois say to Corn Planter, we want you to represent us. You go to the Americans and negotiate. So now he's in this impossible position of he'd never wanted to be involved in the war anyway, and now he has to get what he can out of it. And the Americans basically say, too bad. You're on the losing side. We told you not to fight against us. And ultimately, he and George Washington have two meetings in Washington's presidency. And in the last meeting, it's very poignant. By this time, you know, settlers have moved into their lands, and they're being forced to sell. And meanwhile, a lot of his people back home are saying, you go and you get our lands back. And he knows that's not going to happen. So what he's saying to Washington is, look, we're forced to sell the lands. I've heard that these things exist called banks, and that if you put your money in there, it'll be safe, and our young men won't spend it, and you know, so. And that I've heard about this thing called interest. Can you explain it to me? And so he's basically saying to him, help me get something out of this, something lasting. He really represents the whole native quandary, I think.
And it is a quandary. I mean, it was just so heartbreaking.
And they're totally sold out by the British. You know, when the British negotiate the treaty, they just let them go. They promise that if you ally yourselves with us, we'll protect you. And they just leave them to the mercy of the Americans.
And what I was struck by is, I think for a lot of Americans today, we have a hard time realizing that the power and the cultural military power that these native groups had. So at the start of the book, you know, or the beginning of the French and Indian Wars, the Iroquois nations are practically, they're a military power like France and Britain.
Yeah.
With and who they align with is critical. By the end of the revolution, their power has really been sapped away in this global
And they see where it's
struggle.
Going. And so Cornplanter, trying to be a realist after the war, he lives into the 1830s, he's progressively, you know, he's advising that the Iroquois children learn English, that they have schools, and so he's accepting more and more of these things. And then at the end of his life, he has this dream, and in the dream, the creator comes to him and basically says, this is the wrong way. Our people can't be free like this. So you have to turn back. So he tries to turn back the clock. He tells them, forget, let's close these schools, let's stop it all. And of course, you can't do that.
And his view and the Native American view of freedom at the time is very different from the white settlers.
That, you know, I spent time with someone from Ganandagan, which is it's a New York State Museum. It's a Seneca culture museum south of Rochester. And this curator there named Michael Galban helped me in particular to understand the Seneca mindset, what it was like, because it's so hard to do, especially since all the records are written by non-natives. And this concept of freedom, their concept of freedom was, you know, really came down. It was very much like what was coming out of Europe in the 17th century, in that it was really, it came down to the individual. Every individual, not just, you know, your tribe ruled this way, your village could go another way. And within your village, you individually could go your own way. So there was a great deal of freedom, which, ironically, while the Americans are fighting for freedom, they interpret this Iroquois freedom to be like waywardness. You know, they don't even understand it.
And then there's also the role of women among the Iroquois.
They actually, yeah, women had a great deal of freedom as well. They had a certain amount of autonomy. It's a matrilineal society, for one thing, so they had a lot of...
And what does that mean?
The women ran things in many respects. Women decided who they would go to war against, if they would attack a neighboring village or not. So they had a lot of power.
Let's talk about freedom of the press. The revolution is an era when that was a brand new concept, and the role of the press, it was so dominant in spreading these ideas and in circulating some of the ideology and also the kind of cultural energy that made the revolution possible.
Yeah, the press was, everyone recognized that the press was a vital organ for spreading what was going on. And the freedom had been established, in a sense, a couple of decades earlier in New York with the case of John Peter Zengler. The notion that if you report it, and if it's true, you're allowed to report it, rather than, you know, if it's against the government, then you can't report it.
Which lives on today in libel law.
Exactly.
Yes, I mean,
exactly.
The truth is your best defense.
So by the time of the revolution, this was you know, well established now. And the issue had to do with the fact that... the British, where they were not in control, then the American presses printed what they wanted. So they didn't have that issue, if you see what I mean.
Right.
So since you started writing this book, and given that you wrote this extraordinary book, Island at the Center of the World, about the Dutch impact on New York City, how has your view of freedom changed?
I think partly from writing that book and also from having lived for 6 years in the Netherlands, it always, something like that gives you perspective on your home country. And not long after I first moved there, I wrote an article for the New York Times about the experience of living in a, quote, social welfare state. And I had these stereotypical American notions of what that meant, and it really felt different from that. And so I was trying to, you know, tease that out. And there is, the American sense is that you're free as an individual, the more individual, the less you are oppressed by the state. Their sense is they still see government as a representative of the people. Government is the people. Everybody complains about the government, and they have lots of flaws with it, but they still see the government, and therefore when the government is involved in a healthcare system that applies to everyone, they see that as actually, that doesn't diminish your freedom. That increases, that gives you more freedom because it means you don't have to worry what's going to happen to my family if I drop dead. You know, I mean, certain things are taken care of, and that gives you this cushion.
Are there any takeaways from history that we could learn from?
There are these echoes that are still echoing with us. And once again, I think by being aware of that, we can begin to transcend it. The figure of Abraham Yates being this anti-revolutionary who fought right alongside all the patriots in the war, and then the moment it was over, basically turned on them and said, you all are becoming an elite, just like the elite that we just overthrew, so I don't trust you. That you see repeated, this populist theme throughout American history. You see that, I think, now in recent history, both in the people who supported Trump and in the people now who are scared to death of Trump. This very healthy suspicion that those in power are going to thwart you.
Russell Shorto, author of Revolution Song, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you both. It was fun.
So, Jim, there's one thing Russell said that I think, a lot more comfortable with than you are, because I also lived in Europe. I lived in Britain for 20 years. And this idea that the government is there to help you in an ideal circumstance, even though you complain about it.
Right. I think I don't disagree with that in the best scenarios. I think those scenarios tend to happen in countries that had a long history of capitalism that got them there. Amsterdam was one of the world's first capitalist states, and they built up the traditions of individual rights. You have rights over your property. They built up a lot of economic momentum that then allows them to say, okay, let's readjust the dials fairly slightly, and we'll have moderately high taxes, and we'll have nice benefits on the government. But that's not the same as, we're just after the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, when Lenin taking power, is we are going to control everything and strip everything from the owners of property. And you look at what a disaster that was. So my point is that the societies that we think of as being sort of quasi-socialist, they're really not socialist at all. They're capitalist with a pleasant overlay of social welfare. It's a very different thing.
One of the loveliest things about this book that we've just talked about is that it's a thriller. It reads like a novel, but also that the American Revolution and the principles espoused in it are way more complex than they're often painted, and that we can look at freedom from a variety of perspectives and disagree about my view of freedom versus your view of freedom, and yet still celebrate the concept.
Yes. But I want to circle back to something we were talking about a little bit in the conversation with Russell, and that is that freedom is also scary. Freedom is also, sometimes it's intimidating, and we've seen it again and again, societies that have pulled back from it. We see it in fascism. We see it in communism. We see it sometimes in movements that you want to submerge the individual in something, you know, that seems greater than themselves. And we see how easily that impulse can turn
really
dark.
Yeah, we see
it
in religious fundamentalism, too.
Right. So I think we are living in a time right now when the notion of freedom, that really needs to be reaffirmed. Lost the sense of why it mattered so much.
And we've also seen it with the rise of religious fundamentalism in the Middle East and in the West and in other parts of the world. And we see it in the denial of a woman's right to choose, that is wrapped up in a very kind of rigid concept where you're denying, in many cases, somebody else's right to do something on their own.
I don't want to drag this off into an abortion debate.
But it is part of this broader thing of judging the limits right. of somebody else's it's, freedom.
I'm a libertarian, so I don't take a stand. I'm pro-choice, basically. But in defense of those people, if you believe that the fetus has human rights, then that is a question of rights. Now, I don't think we need to litigate that right here, but...
So there's so many different ways to look at this.
You know, and so Russell's book, he talks about the promise of freedom. Slavery is this heartbreaking example of how the promise of freedom was so incomplete, and even today, not fully realized. And I think that, you know, it is really important to keep circling back to those values. And he talked a lot about the Enlightenment. This has come up with Michael Shermer and Neil deGrasse Tyson. That period, that couple hundred years, when we started seeing ourselves as individuals, started turning telescopes up into the sky, started rejecting the authority of the church and saying that we need to use rationalism to understand the world. The most important period in human history, I think, and I actually am quite concerned that those values are being rejected by many, both on the far right, on the far left, Islamic fundamentalists. Across the board, we're seeing people turn away from that challenge of really thinking hard and taking responsibility for one's beliefs.
It's How Do We Fix It? I'm Richard Davies.
And that was not a solution by
No. I think it was, in a way. And our producer is Miranda Schaefer. Yeah. The music is by Lou Stravinsky. We're a production of Davies Content. Find out more at daviescontent.com. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.